Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic. On the 10 westbound, the exit ramp to the 202 Santan Freeway is blocked. And on the Santan Freeway 202 eastbound, there's a crash at Alma School. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high reaching up to 74 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows near 50. Sunny and 75 for tomorrow and Thursday, then a cool down on Friday. It's sunny and 69 degrees at KJZZ. More than 6 million people have visited Grand Canyon National Park so far this year, a record for the park. KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports.
The Grand Canyon has seen a steady increase in visitation in recent years, and this year alone, the park has seen an uptick of more than 7%. Park officials believe the increase is due in part to a social media campaign to raise awareness about the National Park Service centennial. The honor of being the 6 millionth visitor went to a family from Las Vegas, all at the park for the first time. Since the Grand Canyon opened in 1919, more than 200 million people have visited. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Phoenix VA Medical Center hosted an open house for veterans and their families today to help them get the word out about new agency initiatives and talk about challenges they've encountered at the facility. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there this morning and is with me now. So, Carrie, who was at the VA today and how did they address the veterans that came out?
Well, VA Medical Center Director Rima Nelson and the VA Regional Office Director Chris Norton were there. There was also representation from D.C. with Deputy VA Secretary Sloan Gibson. This was his fourth visit to the Phoenix medical facility in as many months, actually. So he described his day so far in Phoenix as more of a working session. He said he spent a lot of time before the open house talking to staff at the VA about what was going well for them and what could be improved on and what he could actually help them improve. So, as far as what has improved, he cited more completed appointments in Phoenix and the addition of a parking garage, which if you've ever tried to find a parking spot at the VA, you know it's tight. And what can still improve, he mentioned primary and specialty care access as specific examples. He said officials are actively working to hire more support staff so that those doctors can eliminate as many inefficiencies as possible. So while Gibson was addressing the media with some of these updates also this morning, he was asked, are waiting lists now under control? And he said the short answer to the question was yes, but
demand and supply are still not balanced here. You know, if we took a snapshot and froze demand 2.5 years ago, you know, I think we'd be looking at a very different situation than the one we've got right now. But we haven't. More veterans are coming to us for more health care than ever. So we're still working to balance supply and demand.
So now to your second question, how did they address the veterans that came out? And so it was a bit of a different setup than they have had when it comes to open houses in the past. This was very open, for lack of a better word. There were no chairs. There, it wasn't an audience speaker kind of setup. It was very open. People just stood in line to talk with the official that they wanted to speak with. And it was very fluid, I would say.
Well, and what kind of reception, Carrie, did those VA officials get from the veterans who came out?
Well, it was warm and cold, really, from what I could tell. One of the first veterans I talked to had just spoken with Rima Nelson, who is the VA Medical Center Director, and he said he was very happy. He was actually a new patient with the VA here, and he said, I had a great experience and wanted to tell her that. Now, other veterans didn't have such a great experience. One veteran that I spoke with, Stephen Richardson, he said he was there to get help getting his disability rating. Now, that's how you get qualified for VA benefits. And he said so far he's faced several roadblocks since he started the process.
I mean, how can I get deployed and then injured and get medically discharged at 20% and then the VA deny me and I'm getting zero? So it's been kind of ups and downs for me.
Now, Richardson says this was the first time he had come out to one of these open house events for help. He said he was about 80% optimistic that it would make a difference in getting his benefits. Veterans also seemed just happy that they could have this access to officials like Deputy Secretary Sloan Gibson and Rima Nelson to be able to air some of their grievances, try to get help. And from what I could tell, as much as they could, they were trying to usher people to the correct place for help or even take them directly to a provider if that was the case.
That's KJZZ's Carrie Young. She covered this morning's open house at the Phoenix VA. Carrie, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
The incoming Speaker of the Arizona House is hinting there may be legal grounds to overturn Proposition 206, the minimum wage hike just approved by voters last month. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, critics of the new law argue the increase is unconstitutional and could hurt the state's most vulnerable citizens.
J.D. Mesnard is considering filing a lawsuit contending the increase is in violation of the state constitution since it deals with contracts already in place with the state. Those contracts, utilizing tax dollars, are used to provide services to the developmentally disabled for both public and private organizations.
As people talk about this or that, one of the things that's come up is this idea of a funding source, because most of the impact of 206 that people have brought up relates to funding.
Arizona's minimum wage rises to $10 an hour next month and then up to $12 an hour by 2020. Hallie Garcia, president of the board of directors of Echo Hope Ranch, which serves the developmentally disabled in Cochise and Pima counties, says her organization has to make up the difference itself.
We hope we're going to be okay for the first round of increases, but when it goes to $12 an hour, it's going to be very difficult for us to keep all of our programs for this important population.
Attorney Jim Barton represents the group that got voters to approve the measure. He contends the constitutional provision Mesnard cites provides no basis to void the initiative and that the state is not obligated to fund the additional dollars.
These are contracts that the state has where it says it gives a contractor a bunch of money to do something, right? Our initiative doesn't mandate any increase in that.
Barton adds that if a contractor's costs go up, that's because they must now pay employees a living wage. Mesnard says he's not yet decided whether to file a lawsuit to challenge the new law. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Arizona's largest border city, Nogales, is facing a tough holiday season. And it's more than just a weak Mexican peso causing problems. Long lines at the border and a lack of traffic in the stores are also contributing. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports downtown Nogales is changing.
It's Christmas season in Nogales, or more correctly, Christmas shopping season. A time of year that should be sidewalk crushing here. Instead, only a few dozen people wander the storefronts running up to the port of entry. Maricela Ibanez crossed from Nogales, Mexico recently to shop for a coat for her young son.
Pues, sí, en lo de las tiendas sí, pero para pasar no. De hecho, hicimos una hora y media para poder cruzar, entonces no sé.
The line to cross was an hour and a half, she says, but she doesn't know why. Here on the street, there are very few shoppers in these old buildings that have stood for the better part of a century. They've played host to the Bonten Mexican consumer for at least 30 years now. For much of that time, Chris Park has been running a massive store on Morley Avenue, just across the tracks from the port of entry. He sells bedding, blankets, and children's wear. After 20 years, he's calling it quits. He says business has been dropping since the Great Recession of 2008, and it keeps dropping.
2015, going down 30% again. And then 2016 is another 30% from 2015. So that's why I'm going to close, end of this year.
He's not alone. Take a stroll down Morley Avenue where the narrow street runs up to the border wall separating the two countries. And it's clear that the face of downtown Nogales is changing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there used to be a buzz about downtown.
Guillermo Valencia is chairman of the local Port Authority. We walk across the tracks where what was once a national bank is now up for sale.
You know, you could feel it. You could get on the street and sense it. You don't see that now. I mean, it's Christmas time. It's Christmas shoppers. You know, and you look around and you say, hey, where are the shoppers? They're not here, you know.
At Bracker's department store, Bruce Bracker sells high-end Stetsons, horsehair belts.
London Fog and Michael Kors jackets. You'll see Guess jeans, you know, Lacoste,
christening dresses, and evening gowns. He put a second store up for sale due to a lack of business. Bracker is also a county supervisor. He's argued for U.S. Customs and Border Protection to streamline traffic and get people across. He's been arguing that point for 4 years now.
You come up to a port of entry, you don't know if you're going to be waiting in line for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or 2 hours or 3 hours to cross that border.
But the Mexican consumer's shopping habits have changed. Nogales, Sonora, just across the border, boasts an enormous shopping mall. There's a Walmart, even a Sam's Club. Up north, there's a seduction of multiple Tucson malls and outlets. 3 blocks from the border wall, the traffic peters out. Here, there's 3 darkened storefronts. The grits on the windows suggest they've stood this way for a while. Arnold Quijada is chairman of the Chamber of Commerce. His solution? Nightlife.
Why not? But if we want to take care of these people, we want to attract them and keep them here, let's give them some choices. So let's put a few bars out there, you know? I mean, some investors, bring a few bars, bring a few nice restaurants.
Nogales, he says, needs to become more than a quick stop on the way into the rest of Arizona. In Nogales, I'm Michel Marisco, KJZZ News.
And Michel joins me now. And Michel, can you sort of describe for us, like, what does this area of Nogales look like, the shopping area that until recently, it seems, had been attracting visitors and shoppers from across the border?
It looks a lot like the Wild West. That is to say, there's these brilliant facades of the buildings that look that they've been there at least a century. Many of them have. And many of these are now storefronts. They've evolved this way since, you know, the 70s and 80s, drawing in Mexican shoppers, mostly on foot. This area is really narrow streets. There's not really space for cars to be able to park. So a lot of this was really targeting shoppers who walked across the border from Mexico and came in. Now, a lot of these stores are still open. There's just not very many people anymore.
Does this seem to be a problem just at this time of year with holiday shopping, or is this sort of a full year-round kind of situation?
It's a really interesting situation. So the Department of Transportation keeps track of just how many people come across the Nogales border. They do this for all the ports of entry. In Nogales, in 2006, there were 7.7 million people that came from the Nogales, Mexico side into Nogales, Arizona on foot. That's not including cars, right? This year, there were 3.3 million. Half. And that was actually a little bit higher than the year previous. So there's this issue of there's 3.5 million people who are coming across the border, but they're not hitting these stores any longer. And that's what's leading to these closures.
How much of that do you think is the availability of shopping elsewhere? Your story referenced a mall on the Mexican side of the border, also newer stores up in Tucson.
Tucson has been very aggressive in trying to bring people from Mexico to be able to come up here for the day. So that's a vehicle traffic. There's talk in Nogales, Arizona, of wanting to bring in a Dollar General, a department store like Marshall's or Ross, and put these right in the downtown, right where these other businesses are, in hopes of keeping some of those people in Nogales, Arizona, and not having them come all the way up to Tucson.
All right. That's KJZZ's Michel Marisco in Tucson. Michel, thanks.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. Congress has already signaled it wants to take a look at the reports that Russian hackers may have directly and deliberately meddled in the U.S. election. President-elect Trump has dismissed the reports from the CIA and has even disparaged the quality of U.S. intelligence in some of his statements. But meddling in elections is something the CIA is actually rather good at. Using both covert and not-so-clandestine tactics, it's installed and replaced leaders around the world who are favorable to U.S. policies. Tim Weiner is a reporter and author who's written extensively on American intelligence. He is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his work on clandestine national security programs.
Weiner says election meddling is not a gray area for the CIA.
Several months after the CIA was created in 1947, it set out to steal the Italian election in 1948 to support the Christian Democrats who were pro-American against the Socialist Democrats who were pro-Moscow.
And
they
won.
And
that's just the beginning.
It is just the beginning of a long, long story. It worked. And they took this formula, which is, let's weaponize suitcases full of cash and spread all over Western Europe, all over the Western Hemisphere, into Asia. And money is power, but as we're learning, information is power too.
And was this meddling in political elections directed from the White House, or was this something that the CIA was just doing to meet generalized goals of the Cold War?
The CIA doesn't sit around saying, hey, I've got a good idea. Let's overthrow the government of Iran. No, the CIA does what presidents tell it to do.
And so in the case of Iran, and that, of course, is a very famous example of meddling with the election, the Mossadegh government fell as a result of the CIA's activity. And that's not so much messing with an election. That's an actual coup.
Right. And we set up the Shah of Iran, who was our best friend for 25 years until he fell. And that created the Iranian Revolution, which we're still living with today.
Is the CIA good at this? You've written about what the CIA is dreadful at. Is this particular task something that the CIA is suited to perform?
Yeah, if you want to swing an election in a foreign country and you've got a Halliburton suitcase with $1 million in it, it works.
And when you say information is also power, you're getting closer to the kinds of things that are being talked about in these Russian hacks that, President-elect Trump claims he wants not to talk about.
Well, in denying that Russia ran a successful information war campaign during our presidential election, he is alone in denying that this happened. We are in uncharted waters. We have just seen the Russian intelligence services, led by an ex-KGB colonel, Vladimir Putin, run a number on the United States using information warfare to get inside our heads and, in the opinion of the CIA, not simply disrupt American democracy, but elect Donald J. Trump.
Who then appoints as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who has a $500 billion oil deal in the Arctic with the Russian oil businesses.
That alone would be enough to mark Trump as the Siberian candidate.
The Siberian candidate. I like that. So is the CIA's account of what the Russians purportedly did during the election more or less truthful because of their experience around the world? In other words, they're good at meddling, so they would see this. They would know this.
That is a judgment call. But let's take a step back. The entire U.S. intelligence community and the British intelligence services and the German intelligence service all are in concurrence, a rare harmony and convergence, that Moscow is trying to destabilize Western democracies. Cold War 2.0. What could be more destabilizing to American democracy than electing the great disruptor, Donald J. Trump? These two goals are one and the same. It is the CIA's judgment, its analysis, that electing Trump was part of a larger plan to destabilize American democracy.
If we were to assemble a world tour of places where citizens can say that the CIA and the United States meddled in their election to the point of actually having an impact on the outcome, what countries would we visit?
It would be a world tour. It would go from Iran through Guatemala and Central America, across the Pacific to Indonesia, to South Vietnam. It would then roll over to Afghanistan, where the president after the American invasion, post 9/11, was a paid CIA agent, Hamid Karzai. The list is very long, and it is part of what CIA does in political warfare.
Tim Weiner is the author of Enemies, A History of the FBI and Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, and the most recent, One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome, John.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
A two-story building in West Phoenix serves as a sort of giant ATM for banks across the state. The Federal Reserve's processing center is where banks make deposits and withdrawals to meet customer demands. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes got a rare look inside, and she joins me. So, Christina, what's it like to be around millions of dollars?
Well, it is not very comfortable because I was around a lot of security and bigwigs from the Federal Reserve who were watching and listening to my interviews. Now toss in all that cash, and it was, as one employee described, intimidating.
I was actually petrified.
That's Rick, remembering his first few weeks on the job. We're only using his first name to protect his identity because he works with a lot of money.
When you're, you know, surrounded by so much, I mean, it's daunting. It really is.
So how much are we talking about? Through October of this year, the Phoenix Center processed 850 million bills, or notes, as the Federal Reserve calls them. Abby McLennan manages operations here.
So this is our currency receiving room.
It's where armored trucks deliver bank deposits and employees perform what they call strap and bundle counts.
So the containers that you see in the room, each container can hold approximately 450 bundles.
A container of ones can add up to 450,000, while a container of 20s can total 9 million. The next step in the verification process takes place just across the hall in another room surrounded by glass walls. Before I can enter, McLennan calls for a police escort and has me put on an orange vest.
It's just so they can visually recognize you, that you're not part of the team.
Workers like Olivia feed bills into a big machine.
It's going to go through sensors, and the sensor will detect if the currency needs to be shredded. Or sometimes we have suspect notes that come out.
Suspect notes could be counterfeits, so they're sent to the Secret Service for investigation. Notes that are shredded are considered unfit. They may be worn or torn, which could make it tough to determine whether they're real. In Phoenix last year, machines shredded more than 100 million notes. In the past, McLennan says a company took the residue to create insulation. But now it goes to a landfill.
Just due to changes in the marketplace, but we are always actively looking for ways to recycle that shred residue as much as possible.
Back in the 90s, Arizona developed a reputation for dirty money. At that time, banks had to ship cash back and forth to Los Angeles. To cut travel costs, they often held on to notes past their prime. So in 2001, the Federal Reserve opened the processing center in Phoenix.
I figured we could head down to our vault.
About 50 people work here, along with two non-humans, nicknamed Bonnie and Clyde.
I think Bonnie's the ringleader.
Bonnie and Clyde are automated guided vehicles, and they're the only ones allowed inside the vault. Cranes move up and down, grabbing containers for Bonnie and Clyde to carry to their coworkers.
And we actually have magnets that are embedded in the floor, and that's how they determine where they are going.
For a visitor, being around so much money is a little like breathing in a wallet full of cash. But for employees like Rick, who actually touch it,
it can smell like a casino, smoke. It can smell like a gymnasium, running shoes, or track. It varies, even sometimes like dirt.
Rick also has a different view of all that cash. Remember how he first described his job?
I was in awe.
Well, he says that disappeared after about 3 months.
Now it's a recycling operation. Bring it in, get it out.
But that sense of awe returns when you ask Rick to compare new money to notes that are labeled fit, meaning they've been around a while.
New money is crisp, it's clean, it has that sort of smell of sweet ink. It's very, very different than the fit.
You look like you kind of you have a crush on new money.
you usually know that new money isn't going to come back for quite some time.
So, Christina Estes, it sounds like Rick really likes new money. How long does it stay in good shape?
He does love his new money. The average lifespan for denominations under 20 is about 5 years. Our biggest bill, the one you carry around, the 100,
I wish,
generally lasts the longest, 15 years.
So the $100 bill is the highest denomination produced today, but there was a time when you could actually get a $10,000 bill?
Yes, that's true. It was the highest ever printed for public use. They were last printed back in 1945. The Fed started pulling them out of circulation in 1969.
Okay, so two questions. One, are there any still around? And two, where can I get one?
Well, there are some still around. I couldn't track down a definitive number on exactly how many, but collectors seem to think there are around 300 left. And Mark, if you want to get your own $10,000 bill, it's going to cost a little bit more than face value. The cheapest I found advertised was $165,000.
Yikes. KJZZ's Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
In a check of international news, Iceland hit the global headlines during the financial crisis for all the wrong reasons. The country's bloated banking system collapsed, taking much of the economy down with it. Since then, there's been a strong recovery, and for the last 7 years, it's been named the most equal country in the world in the Global Gender Index put together by the World Economic Forum. According to many locals, the two things are connected. But despite this, many Icelandic women are still fighting to close the pay gap even further, as the BBC's Coletta Smith reports.
This is the central square in Reykjavik, just off the main street. It's probably 100 metres by 100 metres square. It's not huge. There are trees all around, already decorated for Christmas, and at the head of this square is a small building that is the Icelandic National Parliament. And that's why, once every year, it is absolutely packed, full of men and women gathered together to protest against gender inequality here in Iceland. I've come to meet Ashilda and her family to talk about the impact of that event. And Ashilda, you can remember things right back when you were 9 years old. You can remember that event taking place.
I remember the day quite clearly, actually. I remember being really proud that women were gathering and protesting the gender gap.
I am not used to thinking about boundaries.
This is Gudrun Hafsteindottir, who's president of Iceland's Federation of Industries.
There is a glass ceiling, yes, but we are cracking it. I was sitting in this room yesterday.
We're here in your boardroom around a huge board table here.
Yeah, by the Federation of the Industry. And all of a sudden it struck me, oh my God, there are 20 people sitting here around this table and I am the only woman. And I got two emails from guys who were sitting at this table asking me afterwards, who organized this meeting? Where were the women, you know? So our guys, they are noticing it slowly too. So I think we are getting there. And there are many women who are taking big responsibilities here in companies.
One woman doing just that is Birna Einarsdottir. She was given the task of transforming the failed Glitner Bank. So now she's CEO of the transformed bank with a new logo, a new ethos, and a new name, Iceland's Banki.
I think the pay gap is now the biggest issue for closing the gender gap.
Iceland's just a tiny country in terms of population. Do you think size does matter when it comes to being number one in this list?
Absolutely not, absolutely not. I often say women have done everything they can. They are educated, they are getting more experience in workplace. They are interested, but nothing will change until the men are ready to take the subject forward with us. And that, in Iceland, I think that is what happened when CEOs and managers that are men, that they see the importance of the diversified team, that is when things start moving. And that is the cultural changes I'm talking about.
Looking to your bank and the future, do you think Iceland would ever be in a position of getting itself into another boom and bust cycle?
We have rebuilt a different banking system. What I think is different between Iceland and other countries, we needed to start from scratch. I think it is extremely important just to have a diversified group running a bank or either a management team or a board. I think we have learned our lesson.
That's the BBC's Coletta Smith reporting from Iceland. The future of the Affordable Care Act has become one of the biggest questions in Washington and around the country. Republicans in Congress have been talking about repeal and replace, as has President-elect Donald Trump, but there aren't a ton of details about what would replace the ACA after a repeal. One of the areas that would be affected is Medicaid expansion. Arizona is one of the several states that expanded the health insurance program for the poor under the ACA. Robin Rudowitz studies this kind of thing. She's an associate director for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. And Robin, what is the discussion right now as far as Medicaid expansion programs as they relate to the future of the ACA?
Right. I think right now we have a lot more questions than answers about what we might expect around the ACA. There's certainly discussion of a repeal of the ACA. There are also questions of repeal and a potential replacement to the ACA. I think we have a lot of questions about the timing, you know, if those things would happen together, repeal and replace, or if there might be a repeal and then followed by a replace. And there are a lot of provisions that were in the ACA related more broadly, as well as those that affect Medicaid, and it's unclear if all of those would go away or you know, some of them might be maintained. So I think we have a lot of questions about what the overall effect would be of an ACA repeal discussion.
When policymakers talk about doing this, they often discuss trying to leave in or keep some of the more popular provisions of the Affordable Care Act, things like not being able to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions, letting people stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26. Is Medicaid ever discussed in those kinds of contexts of things that maybe policymakers would like to keep in some capacity?
Yeah, and in fact, the Kaiser Family Foundation just put out some results of polling just last week. And along with those provisions that you mentioned that are popular and many individuals favor maintaining those provisions, many individuals, 8 in 10, also favor allowing the states the option to continue to be able to use Medicaid to expand coverage to low-income uninsured individuals, and that included two-thirds of Trump voters.
Is there a way to continue paying for Medicaid expansion absent the rest of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there are two issues with repeal of the ACA and states' ability to continue the coverage. The ACA provided the authority for states to provide that coverage. So prior to the ACA, individuals had to meet both income eligibility standards as well as fall into a specific category to be eligible for Medicaid. So a repeal would eliminate that authority. And it also, of course, provided a significant amount of funding for states to be able to move forward with the expansion. So both of those issues, both the authority as well as the financing, are at risk with a repeal of the ACA without any replacement.
So states basically wouldn't even be able to cover those folks absent that provision in the ACA or some similar provision in whatever comes next.
That's right. There were a few states, including Arizona, that had sought these demonstration waivers to provide that kind of coverage prior to the ACA, but they needed to be budget neutral to the federal government. It was much more difficult, and it was only that coverage was only available through these kind of demonstration waivers.
Have you heard any talk about what people who are currently on Medicaid under the expansion, where they might be able to get insurance if this expansion program goes away?
Well, we know that many individuals who are currently covered by the Medicaid expansion or who are newly covered by the expansion, without that coverage, many of them would be uninsured.
So, I mean, it sounds like there hasn't been really much discussion about like some other kind of program or some other way to help folks get the kind of care that they need in terms of insurance without this specific program that they're currently enrolled in.
Right. The specifics of what might be available as a replacement if this goes away, none of those details have been discussed.
Robin Rudowitz is an associate director at the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Robin, thank you very much.
No problem.
Move-in day. It's one of life's most stressful events, but also maybe one of the most exciting. For some, it's actually life-changing because it means moving off the street or out of a shelter to an address and a space of their own. The show's Annika Klein follows one mom across the threshold.
The first time I spoke with Pilar Ibarra was 2 weeks ago, and she was running out of time. She, her husband, and their 5-year-old daughter were living in a shelter, but there's a limit on how long you can stay.
Yeah, 120 days.
They were coming up on 104. They used to have a 2-bedroom condo. Her husband, Daniel, had a good job.
Him and his brother had an auto glass business, and
we were okay. They made pretty good money and we didn't have to really worry about anything. I was allowed to stay home with my daughter.
A year ago, the steady job disappeared.
My brother-in-law had a major stroke and we lost everything.
Ibarra had never been homeless before, but her family suddenly found themselves bouncing around to friends and family's houses, a hotel room, the street, and then the shelter, all while most of their belongings sat in storage.
We don't have hardly anything in there. We had to sell our furniture. We sold our beds. We sold whatever was big.
The little things left over mean a lot to Ibarra. Family photos, her parents' ashes, her daughter Alyssa's baby keepsakes. Now she's worried her stuff will go to auction because she can't pay for storage anymore.
We have nothing. I don't know how else to explain it. It makes me feel like I'm nothing.
Karina Romero is a housing case manager. She's helping Ibarra.
Our ultimate goal is to make sure that they are able to find a home and stay in a home.
Romero works for A New Leaf, a nonprofit that helps people in crisis. And they approach homelessness with a tactic called Housing First.
Where you get people into homes first, and then you help them resolve their issues. The old way was like, well, you have to have a job or you have to be, you know, staying sober or whatever it is.
This mindset is somewhat new. In 2010, the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness called Housing First the solution to ending chronic homelessness versus treating housing as the end reward after many other steps. Romero again.
People are more willing to go to work every morning when they're waking up in their own home versus a shelter.
I'm ready to move out. I'm ready to have my own place. It's a roof over our head and over our daughter's head. That's all that matters.
And just a week before the deadline to leave the shelter. Move-in day. The first thing into their new apartment is a Christmas tree.
No ornaments yet, but it's nice.
Ibarra's voice echoes in the front room off white walls. There's a bedroom in the back with a balcony, all empty. But that's about to change with a moving truck full of donated stuff. Everything from beds to muffin tins, and a whole team of people to unload it and unpack it.
They've got a place to sit in the family room. They've got a kitchen table and chairs to eat.
That's Joyce Petrowski.
They need dishes and glasses and silverware and cooking stuff.
She started the nonprofit Furnishing Dignity. They collect donations and then furnish the homes of those who were homeless, averaging 10 households a month. And like the name suggests, it's about furniture, but also dignity.
We don't take in any furniture that has stains on it or might be ripped.
I've been wanting one of those.
Ibarra's really excited about a food processor she just discovered in a box full of kitchenware. All the odds and ends she had to give up this year are being unwrapped, like gifts.
Oh, Swiffer Sweeper.
Her daughter Alyssa is in her kindergarten class right now, but Ibarra says she can't wait to show her. She says it's been really hard to watch her little girl go through this.
Saturday, we went to see Santa, and Santa told me that she asked for her stuff out of storage, and I just broke down crying, you know, like...
Ibarra says she's hoping, but doesn't know if it'll happen. But there are dishes in the cupboards and sheets on the beds. And Ibarra plans to make Christmas cookies on the baking pans. The last thing the helpers do before taking off is plug in the tree. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.